You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Halaiva, and it's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul. And on today's show, we'll get the inside scoop on the permaculture revolution with Jeff Lawton. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Aloha, everybody. Today we feature an interview with one of the world's foremost permaculture educators, designers, and revolutionary, Mr. Jeff Lawton. Jeff's instructional videos have introduced countless people, including us, to permaculture practices like rainwater harvesting and creating food forests. Here he is interviewed by Diego Futter on the Permaculture Voices podcast, available for free download on iTunes and at permaculturevoices.com. Let's get right into it with Jeff.
So Jeff, let's go all the way back to the beginning. When did you first learn about permaculture?
Well, it was late 1979, leading to about early 1980 on the Sunshine Coast in Australia. I'd just emigrated to Australia. The first year I emigrated to Australia from England. And I saw the word around, and it seemed to be, it sort of had a magnetism and an inquiry about it that tickled my interest. And then when I looked into it, it was something that kind of brought the old, alternative dreams alive that we had in the 70s, but kind of gave up because, it was just too difficult logistically to get into the idealistic lifestyles we were dreaming about. And because it gave a design system approach to those potentially idealistic ideas we had in the 70s, I started to look into it more and more, and that was the beginning of where we are now.
Did you start tinkering with it before you took your PDC, putting some of those ideas into practice, or was it more just exploratory and then you took a PDC and really dove right in?
No, there weren't that many PDCs going on then. I just happened to be really lucky. I was in a place where there was one of the most active permaculture groups in the world at that time, Permaculture Nambour in Southeast Queensland. And Max Lindegger was the sort of champion of that group. I was able to join that group. And then the first thing I did was take a little introduction course. That was the first educational move I made. And I was sort of trying to figure it out a little bit with the action of the group. Like I say, it was very, very early days, but there was a lot of enthusiasm, and that made me realize how useful local community groups are. So I'm really interested in how we've been able to start those up. And I've got a group that I started 20 years ago this year, still active, and my proudest work actually, setting up local community groups that stay very active and valuable to an area. So then it was about a year later that I'd got in a financial position as a hardworking immigrant to sell a little business I'd started up, and I had a bit of extra capital, and I saw the advertisement for a course in Tasmania with Bill Mollison, the founder of the movement, and I just thought I'd take a couple of weeks off and give it a go. And that really changed everything, of course. That was that transformative event that we have continued to create for people worldwide. And I started, mulching and gilding and planting and, stacking diversity together in all kinds of ways in the urban block that I was in. And that was my first house in Australia. I sold that and bought my first farm, and the adventure really started to happen then. And I made a lot of mistakes and worked too hard really to get the results, and kept learning from that.
What were some of the biggest mistakes that you made at the beginning when you were trying these things out?
Not understanding the sequences of Pioneer's systems. Not understanding the sequence of succession of, and pioneering and allowing plants to work for you and relaxing with the rampancy. I had patterned mainframe systems reasonably well on the ground, but I had a terrible sequencing of plant systems, and I was taking up the slack in the work. So I could see I was creating soil, but it was too much work to create good soil that way, and I needed to let particularly the vegetation do the work for me.
Does that play into the idea of kind of slowing down from a permaculture standpoint, where so many people go out and try and maybe rush a property ahead of what would naturally take place?
It may be if you're in that point in history that I was in, but I think nowadays we know what speeds up the natural system. We understand the sequences of pioneer plantings, so we know we can speed it up. You can be quite confident as long as you actually do pay attention to a good designer who has experience. Very, very positive results. So we've got a lot of runs on the board now, and there's a lot of digital evidence, and you know, we have the information age that we didn't have before to share it so rapidly. I think we can be very confident now that we can move things along very quickly, as long as you're prepared to listen to people that have achieved good results. So, you know, search out people that you admire for what they've achieved and what they do, and don't worry so much if you don't always like what they say.
Now, along the lines of what people say, a fair number of people out there complain about the term permaculture itself being too ambiguous and hard to understand, and people throw a lot of different definitions at it. After you've taught so many people and talked to so many people, what's the most easily digestible definition of permaculture that you've came to?
Well, I think it's a system of design that provides all the needs for humanity in a way that benefits the environment.
And some people like to stretch that idea and definition into everything. In reality, where do you consider the boundaries of what is permaculture and what isn't permaculture?
I think permaculture doesn't stretch into metaphysics, the unproven sciences, although I don't have any problem with people being interested or involved in those metaphysical practices. But I think permaculture as a change maker of the world towards positive abundance can't be tied in with metaphysics or religion. But I have no problem with people having religious beliefs, but we don't need to teach permaculture as a religion or through religion, but it can be taught to people who practice religious activities or religious lifestyles. Outside of that, I think permaculture does work across many, many boundaries and connects many disciplines together. It's a connecting system between disciplines. It orientates towards positivism, and it's solution-based, so it's a positive solution-based connecting system. And as long as it's within the ethics of caring for the earth and caring for people, making it better for people, and returning surplus to those three ethics. The ethics, the first two ethics and the third ethic are really a corollary of each other. If you're caring for the earth, you're caring for people, and you're also returning surplus to earth care and people care.
Yeah, what about the stretched third ethic that people use, the whole fair share?
I just think that's a trendy way of rhyming with people care, earth care, and fair share. You don't watch that you're just rhyming for the sake of rhyming. That's like pattern for the sake of pattern without any rhyme or reason or rationale or legitimization. One of the most dangerous things you can do in permaculture is say it's got to be patterns. So let's just make it all, you know, curly and spirally and you know, pretty shapes. You've got to rationalize and legitimize every placement and connection you make, because that's what makes it a design system that provides all our needs. So I think that's just a rhyme, and we should be very careful with that. Fair share means everybody gets a fair share, even if you're a real bad bastard. There's a few of them out there. It's like, let's not be naive.
Yeah, I think people often stretch that definition of fair share into meaning that all permaculture should be free. All classes, all courses, all conferences, all literature, any videos, it should just be distributed for free of charge for the benefit of humanity. And that seems to be a big problem out there, and people fall back on this fair share, quote unquote, third ethic.
That'd work fine. That'd work fine if money was free, but money isn't free. And at the moment, money makes the world go round and makes good videos or trashy videos if you don't have any money, or, you know, good books or trashy books, or good courses or trashy courses. So, well, when money's free, that'll be the case, but money isn't free, and it pays for things to be done well. And pulls people out of the matrix, which is mostly the computer screen or the flat screen of some type. We're all turning into screen agers, and we're stuck in that sort of matrix type iconic position of dumbed down, fully informed, totally incapable, and completely disturbed or scared. You know, that's where we're headed.
So you think people are just, they're learning, but they're not doing?
Well, people know everything just with a click of a button. They got the world's libraries, the whole world's information right there. They'll tell you that. They know everything. Don't need to do anything. You just get it online. But they can't do anything. They can't set a broody chicken. You know, they won't be able to boil a cup of tea pretty soon. They're losing their capability to interact with the world around them. So they're signing out of the game. It's literally like the theme of the Matrix film. You may as well be plugged into a machine with full stimuli and no body process. It'd probably take up less space, wouldn't it? And when those of us that are out there doing stuff, you know, we could get on with the game. But there really is only one game in town.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to actually going out there and doing the work. And one thing I find with permaculture that maybe gets overemphasized is this whole claim of lazy gardening, this very low input, very high output model. Do you think that gets overemphasized too much?
Well, it does by the lazy people, but obviously you feel like there's an obligation to help everybody become a lazy gardener instead of just 1% of the privileged, informed permaculturists, because 99% of the people are out there not realizing they're part of the problem, and they're sort of dumbed down and conned by it. But as soon as you aim at the 99% of people that aren't yet connected, they're absolutely transformed by their connection to permaculture. So I think we're going to stop talking to other permaculturists and get on to talking to the people that want to be spoken to, instead of arguing and singing to the choir about whether it's free, whether it's not free, who's doing what, and why and when. I mean, sure, I could sit down here and I could garden away, and I could tell all the students and interns that are outside just going to the campground to leave, and life would be a lot easier and a lot simpler. And I could just cruise and stop talking to you because I don't need to, and like switch all my website off and the videos and the connecting systems I've made with Permaculture Global and all the other stuff, and you can all go and get nicked, and I'll just be a lazy gardener. And by the way, that'll be free for me now. So, well, what good is that? I actually feel obliged to get up while the dawn stars can still be seen and work every hour there is, because I think we need to. I mean, I feel sorry for the 99% of people who haven't had a connection yet. I mean, life's still awful. And life for me is great, even though it's hard work. I don't think that's a bad thing. I could be a lazy gardener, but I'd feel sort of guilty. And I think you should. But if you just have no connections, no communication skills, and you don't think you can ever pass the passion on to somebody else, well, I suppose you're better off being a lazy gardener than a, you know, production consumption maniac who's just costing the world too much energy. I mean, yeah, but like, let's get it in context, eh?
Yeah, no, I'm in agreement with you there. I mean, I think it takes work, and you got to go out there and find your passion, continue spreading the message. So how do you think we go out and start reaching some of those other 99%? Do you just target them in ways that you wouldn't target the 1%? Go to what they go to, look at what they look at. Do you start just converting conventional farms over to organic as the first step? What's the process there?
I don't think organic farms, I don't think conventional farms can be organic and sustainable. They can be organic and unsustainable, and that's too slow a process. I mean, it's a paradigm shift completely. So I think you just go for the 99% and you go for where they spend most of their time, which is on television or looking at a screen on a computer or an iPhone or something. I mean, there's no other way we're going to get them quick enough. So we have to get them where they are, and they're stuck in the information age quest of social media and all those things. So that's where the action is, where there's thousands and thousands of people you can connect to. And you can see people are doing it. It's quite obvious in the online. And that only creates more and more people wanting face-to-face courses and face-to-face experience on the ground. But there's only so much of that we can facilitate until we prove that we need to be subsidized. We are the future on-ground universities of the world. There's no question about that. Universities are pretty well useless, aren't they? They don't do anything except cost a lot of money and ruin people's lives. They never end up actually working in what they study. They just go and study and then do something else and suffer for the rest of their life. So, like, people come to institutes to learn what is relevant to them and so they can have a meaningful life.
Do you think that people who start studying permaculture and take PDCs are actually doing enough work outside of the PDC? Because it seems like a lot of people get interested in permaculture, they take PDCs, but you don't see enough people going out there and really practicing it, pushing the limits and trying to take things to the next level. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's the gauge of whether you're a good teacher or not. And that's the only gauge of a good teacher, is whether your students are active and whether they become better teachers than you are, and better designers and consultants than you are. And then after that, they produce better institutes than you've produced. And that's what you should aim at. And if you're theming in that direction, that's what you'll get. And if you're not getting it, you should stop teaching. And that's what we're getting. And if we didn't get it, we'd stop teaching. So we're getting more and more active students all the time, and they increase in activity. We're getting more and more teachers all the time, and we're getting more and more institutes established all the time. And if we weren't, then I wouldn't do it.
And do you think it's important to start seeing a lot of these students scaling up these systems in size to take it permaculture to a much larger level, like things like Mark Shepard's doing, where it's big, broad acreage examples versus these smaller case studies?
A little bit, because there's only so many broad acres, but there's millions of home gardens, billions of home gardens. You know, like, so we can go to a certain size and then we're out of order. We're out of the order of size when we get too big. Some landscapes will handle larger systems because they're empty landscapes. They're not so fertile, or they've got less favorable weather conditions. But if you're going to do Arctic permaculture or desert permaculture or really high altitude permaculture, they might be larger in size. But if you're going to do really fertile, flat country, which is really easy, you don't have to be so big. There's no necessity for that. It's just depleting the third ethic down. But what we really need to see is just millions of people, billions of people moving in the same direction with the same intention. That'll do fine. We don't need, you know, billions of farms. We just need billions of people with the same intention, moving in the same direction and making the same level of commitment. And once we get the 11 to 18%, we'll probably just tip, and then the whole world will move together. And I think it will be an evolution, and just of the human brain. So when we started reading and writing, we grew an extra synapse, a very thin layer on the outside of our brain. And that will happen again. We've got one more final layer to grow on our brain.
So looking back in the history of permaculture, we're 30 years into this now. Do you think that we've made good progress so far getting towards that tipping point, or do you think we should be farther ahead by now?
I think we're right on time. It's going extremely fast, and it's getting faster every second. And we've never been able to keep up with the inquiry coming our direction, and that inquiry is getting greater all the time. So we've never got enough teachers, and we've never got enough consultants. And we probably never will have, and then we'll hit tipping point, and it'll just be normal. It'll be the way humans behave. We can all go home then and be lazy gardeners.
Outside of seeing more people just practicing permaculture, is there anything you want to see more of within permaculture, like areas of focus, things like controlled testing of some of these ideas on different scales?
Not particularly as far as testing is concerned. I think, you know, it's pretty obvious. Why don't you just record the amount of food that you're pulling in and the amount of lack of energy that you're using and the lack of embodied energy in your buildings and the extension of their life over that embodied energy. You know, these are pretty straightforward things. I mean, how much energy you use in your house, how many kilowatt hours a day, most people don't know. You know, how much water do you use in a day? Most people don't know. How much food do you produce? For most people, it's nothing. How much have you worked on, you know, renewable building resources, like how many, you know, structural tree plantations or structural trees have you been involved in planning to replace your building materials? They're not really complex research. It's quite diverse, but I don't think that proving that is going to make any difference to people. Like, why would it? They're different trees, they're different buildings, they're different gardens. Everywhere you go, everybody's after a quick fix, simple little answer. You know, it's like vetiver grass is going to save the world, or biochar is the answer to everything, or compost tea. You know, everybody wants a singular fix. It's more interesting than that. It's really diverse, and it's pretty obvious when you got it right. You know, you've got more and more water retention in your landscape, you've got more and more life diversity, and your soil's getting better in quality and quantity. So your water's getting better in quality and quantity first, and then your soil's getting better in quality and quantity second, and your life systems and your products and your health is getting better because you've got more minerals in your diet and you've got more nutrient-dense food. You know, it's sort of, why do we need to test all that stuff? It's pretty obvious. We just need to get on with it.
Along those lines of just going out and doing it, do you think that there's too much emulation in permaculture versus origination, where people just assume I have to do it exactly like somebody else did, and then they just lose sight of common sense observation and experimenting on their own site, you know, just basing that on generally accepted ideas? You know, it seems like so many people just want a recipe that they lose sight of just going out and trying something based upon that pattern understanding.
No, I think it's quite the opposite, actually. I think there's not enough emulation of good systems, and everybody wants to be the originator of something, so they become famous. Everybody's trying, you know, a lot of people try something that doesn't work just for the sake of, maybe if it works, I'll be famous. And, you know, if you go out on aid, permaculture aid projects, you soon get cured of that one, because what you do today feeds people tomorrow, and people suffer if you just go out there experimenting on them. People are not to be experimented on, especially in aid situations. Look, people just don't follow the rule book, and it's pretty well written. Bill Mollison wrote 14 chapters in the Permaculture Designer's Manual. They're written in a fantastic order, and at Permaculture Voices, I want to talk about that. But, you know, the order has great meaning. It's very rational the way it's written. Even every single title of every chapter, you know, is very well thought out. People try and reinvent the wheel. They don't go out there and just do the basic permaculture very often. After you've done the basic permaculture and you're feeding yourself and you're supplying your own water and your house is all working on low energy and low embodied energy, and, you know, your waste systems are all working well and that they're a benefit to the environment instead of a problem, then you might come across some innovation that might help with your fame desires.
This is In the Garden on the Farm, and we're listening to permaculture visionary Jeff Lawton.
Yeah, I'm more thinking along the lines of people seem to get hung up on, you know, what is the exact species of tree I need to plant on my property to fix nitrogen, instead of just looking around their neighborhood and saying, hey, there's black locust here, there's Tipuana tipu here, I'll just plant that, where they're trying to seek out some exotic species and know that it's going to be 100% perfect. And I find that, at least from when I talk to people, that people just want somebody to tell them what to do. Like, they're obsessed on putting swales on their property when they don't have overland flow and things like that. They just default to a recipe that they believe is appropriate versus going out there and looking at the site and just saying, hey, what are the basic permaculture ideas? And let me just do stuff on that and not be obsessed with, I need to do A, B, C, D, E.
Yeah. Well, Robin Francis says there's no dogmas in permaculture. If you start using dogmas in permaculture, one day your dogma gets run over by your karma. Like, I tell people, try every legume tree that grows in your area and see which ones self-select out. Try all the fruit trees you can. Go for the ones that work best, obviously, first, but then add everything else and just see whether they perform for you. And if they perform, extend them. If they don't extend them. And the same around your garden, you know, with your vegetable crops and things. So some things, some varieties work well, other varieties don't. Trial them out. I mean, if you've got someone down the road who's been doing it for 20 or 30 years already, well, go and ask them, for goodness sake. If you're in an area where you've got traditional food forests that might be hundreds of years old, it's a lot easier to go and ask them first than do, you know, 10 or 20 years trialing. And as we put down systems, it gets easier and easier for people that we can say these assemblies are winners and these assemblies might work. They're 50-50 chance of working. And these assemblies are a rare chance of working, but there's a 20% chance they work, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and along the idea of all these permaculture techniques and lessons, when people finish a PDC, they're often overwhelmed with a lot of ideas, techniques, and such. What advice do you give to your students on what to do next, where they should focus their own energy?
Probably on Facebook, you know, or social media systems. Talk to other people where you can communicate quickly and get to find out what they're doing and stay inspired. Talk to your class Facebook page. You should have already made one. Communicate on Permaculture Global, because there's people all over the world. Try and find people around the world in your same climate analog, landscape climate similarity, and, you know, keep yourself buzzing and talk to them about something you're doing that's worthwhile and they're interested in. So in other words, that forces you to get out there and garden and do a few things, so you've got something to socialize with on the internet.
And what are your thoughts on larger rotational grazing, organic style farms, and calling them permaculture, where they may not have water harvesting systems, tree systems involved in them, but they're sustainable in the sense that they're recycling all their waste, they're rotationally grazing animals through the system, and they're feeding, you know, thousands of people. A lot of times I'll hear, well, that's not permaculture. My response is, well, that's better than most people are out there doing.
Well, that's probably true, isn't it? If they are sustainable, if they're buying their feed for the animals, it needs an energy audit on that buy-in of feed. If they're buying their baby animals to fatten them up to sell them on, and they're not breeding their own animals, it's a different energy audit. So it might be a low level of sustainability compromising with the present commercialization of farming. And that's better than just, you know, your industrialized chemical farm that doesn't really care about the environment, but they're making good money anyway. But I think we should have the intention to take it a little bit more sophisticated than that. There's no such thing as a simple permaculture system. It's just, that's an oxymoron. It can't be a simple permaculture system. There's no such thing. So if you simplify it too much, you've obviously compromised the system. We do that out of the convenience of commercialization of permaculture. And I think it's a cowardly way to go about it. You're obviously lacking courage to move further in a sort of paradigm shift towards the abundance we know is possible and we're entitled to, really.
Shifting gears a little bit to audience questions and things along that line, with some stuff, projects that you have going on right now, one question that keeps coming up is, when's the next online PDC starting?
It'll probably be somewhere around the end of March, beginning of April sort of time, I'm guessing. We're giving a lot of free videos away, and we're fielding the larger audience for the questions in relation to those, and they'll help us create larger, more detailed videos on those subjects. So people seem happy with that, and we've only got the energy for the quality of online course that we provide probably once a year. We've only produced one last year, and we might only be able to do one this year because it's 12 weeks plus the design exercise, and we kept the online video section alive from May until December last year. And it's going to be sort of similar this year, but we've got more and more information, and we've got more and more video. We're really looking forward to it. So we've got about another 8 or 9 videos that we'd like to release, and we're releasing them every Friday morning American time. And we think it's helping. We don't know, but we think, you know, the response we're getting is people are, you know, getting a lot out of it. We put quite a lot of work into it, and we're increasing the quality all the time. So we're thinking somewhere around maybe the end of March, beginning of April, somewhere around there, we'll start to offer and see what response we get.
Yeah, one of those really popular videos was the one with Carl Hammer and the Vermont Composting Company. What was your overall take on what they were doing there? You know, what did you learn from visiting that site?
I learned that the inoculum of a compost by releasing what almost appears to be a macro predator over the microorganism event at the beginning of the cycle is probably a great enhancer of the end results quality.
Tying into that video, you have a new chicken composter video coming out. What's the status on that? How's that project going along? Because I've had a few questions related to that.
Yeah, I've got the on the same desk as this laptop. I've got the metal order lengths and cut lengths that I'm just about to put the order in. I'm just about to make it up. It's a mechanical engineering project that I'm running with my interns right now. So let's say if I get it done, if I get the engineering side of it done in the next few days, it's going to be about 6 weeks away because I want to take the compost through to the final cycle. Composting is a passion of mine. So I'm absolutely sure that it'll work. I just want to make sure we get it very well videoed and explained because I've seen the level of interest. The most recent video, Cold Climate Urban with Eric Tosmeyer and Jonathan Bates, has been just as popular actually. So it's really interesting to see what the people out there aiming at the 99% are really interested in.
I think the plants and food systems are always what lures people in. It's just a universal bridge that connects people together. Along those lines, one question that somebody had are there any trees and perennials that you might recommend for the arid equatorial tropics, specifically Kenya?
You're talking about nitrogen-fixing trees?
I'm assuming that so, yeah.
Well, there are leucinas that grow there, and of course there are prosopas that grow there. There's the larger trees, the Albizia lebec, grows there as well. a lot of the arid tropics have very spiky trees, and they're a little bit hostile when you're working them through into climax productive trees. But the leucaena is very good like that. It's not, you know, the dryland leucaena is not spiky at all. So that's one of the better ones. There are some small cassias, varieties of cassia that work in that climate. And there's often casuarinas, which fix nitrogen as well as phosphorus, although they're not a legume tree. So they're all pretty good. I don't think Gliricidia stretches into the dryland tropics. If you've got enough moisture retained, if you've got some earthwork systems in, you might get into Gliricidia, which is one of the classics of the nitrogen-fixing trees of the tropics. It's great forage, not spiky, and it grows from cuttings. But as a rugged pioneer, I think the leucaena, the dryland leucaena, is great. I don't mind working with Prosopis. In the larger trees, I think Albizia lebec is one of the greater large trees of the tropics, dryland tropics.
Switching to wetlands, what are the best uses of a wetland in a temperate climate?
Aquaculture. And when you, whatever you dig in wetlands, you gain in soil. So you intensify the water, and by default that, and as long as you've got a reasonable design sense, that intensifies the land. So you get drier land and wetter water. So the wetland turns into a cold climate chinampa, where you've got 50% water and 50% land, or some ratio like that. And you've got one of the most productive, sustainable systems for that climate on Earth.
Switching from temperate to subtropical, similar question. What would you recommend for wetlands in a subtropical marsh, alluvial land like we have on a river delta here in Argentina? Same thing, chinampas?
Same thing, but if it floods across the delta, then I'd put in mulch and silt traps, planted out with whatever species work well in that particular environment. So I'd put up your, if you were going to dig out canals, you could put up earth banks or raise the soil as well. And if it floods across the landscape, you can catch, you know, thousands or millions on large land, you know, tons of mulch and sands and silts, which will build you up very fertile soil banks and give you enormous amounts of organic matter. So you go through great pulses of fertility as you actually repattern your delta to be a truly deposition system. It's a depositing system rather than an extracting system. So with all those sort of wetland systems, you've got to keep your pattern right, but water only sits flat in the landscape. So as you pattern your way across those subtle contours, you end up in incredibly diverse polycultural, partly aquatic, partly terrestrial production systems. And you should be so lucky.
One of your other videos that you put out recently was the one on village homes up in Davis, California. Would you consider that a climax permaculture design, not just in terms of plant systems, but how the structure, access, and everything was integrated into that community?
Yeah, I would. I think it's an amazing system for its time, and it's set an iconic model that should be replicated and subtly extended so that we can refine it slightly. It's pretty amazing what Michael Corbett created on pretty flat landscape, and it was an empty cornfield to start with. And considering there's a historic event when Davis flooded with almost a foot of water plus, and there was quite a potential for a lot of damage, and village homes opened up all their stormwater and sucked the town dry. So if the town had been designed in the same style as village homes, it would never have flooded in the first place. It would just have absorbed the floodwaters and increased the mineralization of the town's perennial food supply. I mean, it makes total sense to do this stuff. Village homes is an icon of an example. I'm not saying that it's perfect. There's things you could do a little bit better, but it's pretty good for being 38 years old.
Is there anywhere else in the world that you've seen that is comparable?
No, not that's been built with intention. There's some old traditional systems and old traditional gardens, but no intentional community that was built with that purpose in mind. I can't believe it's not being sold as an idea more strongly, actually. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm with you, especially in the U.S. here, where people just love the idea of subdivisions and having these houses built like this. Village homes translates is something that's not an eco community that's located out in the middle of nowhere, off the grid. It's integrated right into suburbia, yet it has all those components that everybody would want, especially here in California. That stuff's all chic. The fact that you're growing food, you're harvesting water, people dig that. So why they aren't building more, I don't know.
Well, I think we sort of missed it for a while, and that was my intention to really like rev it up and promote it a bit. The rest of the world's probably going to leave America behind and win the race there, I think. I think there's a lot of places worldwide that are now jumping on board.
Now, one thing that people have proposed a lot is organizing communities based on watersheds. If you could design your own watershed, starting at the top of your watershed and working down, how would you design that to help improve water quality and quantity?
Mostly with swales and water absorption systems, so the water slows down thousands of times more than it would running at the surface, and resurfaces on the impervious layers here and there as spring lines where you run it sideways again. And then you design your community to share those contour lines of soakage, so we all understand the responsibility we have to continue extending and planning those systems to provide our needs. I mean, it's one of the biggest links to soil fertility is understanding water harvesting, because water harvesting done the right way actually allows us to increase the diversity of life systems. And they're the soil creative systems, and they can also be the providers of our needs in every way, not just food. So all our resources can come from living systems, but you don't really get that availability until you know how to harvest water. So if you look at the Permaculture Designer's Manual, there's only two chapters that actually have a single word title, and one's water and one's soil, and they're right smack bang in the middle of the book. Right. And it goes water, soil. So, and water comes after trees and their energy transactions. It's not about trees. It's their energy transaction. That comes after climatic factors. So climatic factors focus the way you design and give you an idea of why the landscape shaped the way it is in its profiles. And then trees and their energy transactions are the way you moderate those climatic factors, and you do it by also understanding water that leads to soil. And then from there, you can go into the three different climate types that you know worldwide are completely different in the way we approach design. One is the humid tropics. One is the dry lands, and that's the only one with the word dry in it. And the other one is the humid, again, cool to cold. So you have two humid major climates. One's tropical, one's cool to cold. And that one, the other one is completely different again, and it's dry land. That's pretty well outlined in the designer's manual. And if you look at those as basic instructions of how to act as a designer, you can't go very far wrong. Everything else is going to be an evolution that you're going to see in the physical processes that you apply. So what you then do is you let your system demonstrate its evolutions, and then you dynamically adjust.
You're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm, and today we're listening to permaculture visionary Jeff Lawton.
And along those lines of water, what are your thoughts on keyline? Comparing keyline versus permaculture earthworks in a landscape, when do you apply what?
you need to apply them both at the same time. Key line is part of permaculture. Permaculture is not part of key line because key line is only about water harvesting. We're about a lot of things. So key line is a wonderful coat hanger in the wardrobe of permaculture. And so is biodynamics, and so is oil, you know, all brick minerals, and so is cell grazing, and, you know, so is the, you know, soil food web, and, you know, they're all coat hangers in the wardrobe of permaculture. We don't design coat hangers, we design wardrobes to hang up the clothes that allow us to dress in different ways. It's the way we order the valuable information and knowledge of humanity so we can survive in an abundant future. You've got to have a wardrobe, otherwise all your clothes are sitting on the floor. It's a mess.
So it's just another strategy, another tool to use within the bigger toolbox.
It's a water design system within the greater system, and it works in between swales, and it works in particular landscapes, and it works in particular soils, and it's applied mostly with some tractor implements. I mean, it's also a way to think. So everything that we do is a way to think as well as a way to apply action, but we should move from thinking. Once we've got the ABC, the Sesame Street of permaculture, we should move into a directive to act and take some action, because if we sit around thinking too long, we don't get anything done. Information that's not acted on is just useless.
And along the lines of swales, this may not be an easy question to answer, but you've put in a lot of swales. Is there a general rule of thumb of how wide, how deep, and how far apart people should space swales based upon the slope on a landscape? Because that seems to come up a lot. How many swales do I put in, how far apart, and how big should they be?
No, it's not just slope. It's the size of the property. Because if you put a giant swale on an urban block, you won't have anything but a swale and nothing else. Put a giant catchment swale from a desert on an urban block of land, and you know, the D9 bulldozer makes a lot of mess. So it's the size of the land makes the size of the swale relevant as well, and the amount of catchment that you get in, the depth of the soil, and the climate that you're in. So you don't need giant swales in the humid climates as much as you need them in the large desert catchments. Then the slope is relative to what you're going to plant on the swales. So both Bill Mollison and P.A. Yeomans from Keyline talked about the height of the trees, the maximum height of the trees on the swales, so because swales are tree-growing systems. That's what they are for. They're for growing trees, right? So the height of the full-grown climax trees you're planting as a horizontal line back in the landscape from the top of the trees to the next swale is the maximum distance between swales. You don't want it any closer than that. But when you come out onto the flat country, that distance increases too much. But something else happens on flat country. You get into a lot of wind effects because there's nothing to stop the wind. So once you get out into the windy flats, you start to space your swales in relation to wind buffering to the height of the trees. How high are your trees? How far apart then do you need your swales? So you're taking the wind stress off the landscape. Now that might be cold wind stress in the colder climates, or it might be heat and evaporation wind stress in the hot deserts, but it's still wind stress.
In switching to dry lands, what's been the biggest gainer there when you're trying to get growing systems up and running? I know it's slowing evaporation, but is it mulch? Is it shade? Is it a combination of all of the above?
Yeah, it's definitely a combination. You need every trick in the book as an anti-evaporation strategy to start the game. So increased shade, increased wind buffering, increased organic matter, and increased water infiltration will all help you get the dry land started. And of course, you've got to have good timing. So dry land strategies, the chapter in Bill Mollison's book, chapter 11, the largest chapter in the book, dry land strategies. Strategies means time, how you do it, but how and when you do it. So it has a time element, strategies. It's very much about timing. You plant at the wrong time in the dry lands, it doesn't work. more than any other climate.
Now, with over 1,500 people in your latest PDC, what are the most common questions you get asked? Is there anything, you know, that you always see and you think are just, hey, these are great questions?
Unfortunately, I don't think they're great questions, but there's ones I see a lot. I'm quite concerned about some of the questions actually that come up all the time. But what's contour? And what do you do about mosquitoes in water? Very common. People don't understand aquatics, and the mosquito larvae breathe air and they wriggle up to the surface and are the perfect fish food for even the smallest fish. And they don't understand what level is. They don't understand contour. They don't understand that there's a continuum of form in the landscape. And when you put a contour line around it, you're curving around that continuum of form. That's a really big one. And then the third one is, what do you do in flatland? How does it work in flatland when you haven't got any hills? I mean, you should be so lucky to have flat land. I mean, you know, you don't have to walk up and down hills. That saves you a hell of a lot of energy. And there's no such thing as perfectly flat land unless you've made it like they have in Holland, and you can still do plenty of things, or you're on a salt pan. Like, most flatland means it's got very slight slope, so it actually holds more water. You only need a little swell bank to hold up hundreds of feet of water behind it, or even, you know, miles or kilometers of water. You know, very small swell banks hold up more water more passively, so you get less erosion if you're doing the right thing. And all you need is a few windbreaks. And you haven't got much head pressure in flatlands, but you've got lots of wind power to pump water up to tank stands and get minor head pressure that is fine. You've got lots of other advantages. Everything's easy in flatlands, and I can't understand why people don't get that. They're romanticized by the patterning of swaled hill country. And they kind of have lost the common sense of swales and flatland application. They don't know about fish much and mosquitoes, and level in general is kind of a mystery to some people. It's kind of like contour map dyslexia, and I can sympathize with that. I'm a little bit dyslexic in words myself and writing.
And based on your views of permaculture today, where do you see the biggest needs for all these students that are graduating from PDCs?
They need to feed the people in the city, and they need to work on urban and perimeter urban agriculture very quickly, because that's where we can do most good, and that's where more people are arriving every day. So we're more and more urban every day, and we can help a lot of that population. And from there, we can repopulate the neighboring landscape of the urban areas. I think the wilderness can repair itself very well if we just leave it alone, and we may well have to. We can produce the same amount of nutrition, not food. There's a big difference between food production today and nutrition. So we can produce the same amount of nutrition on the equivalent area, not the same area, but an equivalent area of about 4% that's now being used by industrial agriculture globally. We need to realize that, and that immediately creates a beautiful world, and one that we'd be proud of, and won't be overpopulated. It'll be underpopulated, actually. And if we want to extend our work into the broader landscape, we probably need more people than what we've got to repair it quickly.
Yeah, great answer to that. And that's really all I had. That's all the questions. I want to thank you for coming on. Any other final words in closing here?
Well, it should all be fun. If you're having fun, you've got the design right. If you're not having fun, you've got the design wrong. Sit down, have a cup of tea, and think about it.
We've just heard a one-on-one interview with permaculture practitioner Jeff Lawton. If you want to find out more about his work, check him out at jefflawton.com. That's G-E-O-L-L-A-W-T-O-N fflawton.com. Permaculture Voices is a podcast and also a new annual conference. Special thanks to our friend Alex Landry, who attended the first conference and brought Permaculture Voices to our attention. And if you go there, you'll see there are a lot more interviews by permaculture leaders, visionaries, and practitioners. I think you'll find it really interesting. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. We'd like to invite you to tune in next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.